They say you don't know what you don't know.
But how do you know you don't know what you don't know, you know?
Wordplay aside, it's true that when you pick up the news, you don't know what you'll find.
Moreover, you don't know how you'll feel reading it. Will you be sad due to a tragedy or uplifted by a wholesome story?
Have you ever wondered, though, why the things you read in the paper are in the paper at all?
Have you ever found out something you'd consider to be big news, but it wasn't covered?
Do you ever consider how the information you receive changes you just by knowing it?
The news, mental hygiene, and information hazards, coming right up.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
All right, David, what are we talking about today?
I think this week we should talk about the news.
The news?
Not Huey Lewis in the news. That would be a better topic, though.
That would be a way better topic.
We should talk about them instead.
All right, cool.
But we didn't prepare for those, so we're talking about the boring news and how bad it is for you.
Yes. So what is so bad about the news?
It hurts me inside.
No, I think that in general, I guess we could classify this whole thing as how knowledge can negatively affect you.
Sure.
I guess your mental hygiene.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an interesting point, because I think when you talk about, I mean, people already can't agree on your physical health, what's healthy for you, but I would think that most people at least would have some understanding that there are some things that you can do physically, like actions you can take, things you can eat, whatever, certain lifestyles that will lead you to become physically ill, right? Or physically weak. That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Even if we can't agree on what those things are. But I don't think people often talk about your mental health in that way. Like, I think that we look at mental health differently as like, oh, well, this is just a thing that affects you, and don't necessarily look at the external factors as to like, or we think of it as something that you're kind of born with, right? Like, I know people that are anxious that most people would say, like, oh, well, they're just born anxious.
Yeah, people, you sort of attribute it to their personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's not really the case.
No. Your personality can play a part, I think. Just like your physicality, there's things that, you know, some people are just naturally tall, some people have naturally higher metabolisms than others. But we don't say, oh, well, actually, that's not true. I know some people that say, like, well, I am my weight because I have a naturally low metabolism. It's like, yeah, but if you didn't eat as much, you would be smaller, you know? I think it's the same thing. If you're an anxious person, your exposure to more maybe anxiety-inducing information might tend to make you more anxious to the point where you're paranoid.
Sure.
Right. But we don't ever think about the things that you're exposing yourself to information-wise. It's always, oh, well, they're just an anxious person. You know, I say that. Maybe I'm miscategorizing most people, but I at least don't hear it discussed very much.
Mm-hmm.
So is what about the news makes it so bad, I suppose? Like, why the news specifically and not just information in general?
Well, the news is privately operated for the most part. And so they have an incentive to show you, to tell you the stories that they think are going to get you to watch again,
mm-hmm.
or read again or whatever. And it turns out the most effective way to do that is by producing outrage.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so the news will constantly show you stuff that makes you upset all the time. And that's not good for you.
No, I would agree. I think we all know somebody who's like that, that is always like perpetually mad about something.
And will tell you what they heard on the news. Yeah.
Oh, and that too. Yeah. Anybody who has like older family members, be it your parents or grandparents, that you spend adequate amounts of time around, and also you yourself do not watch the news. And when you and I say the news, I mainly am thinking about like syndicated television news stations. So there might be your local news, but it's a branch of a national news source,
right?
And it's all syndicated. Same thing with print news, like newspapers tend to be similar, you know, although nowadays it's more online blogs and stuff like that. That I know, Like, weirdly enough, I remember at one time when I was working at this company, there was a group of guys, well, people, that would get together and talk, and they all had, like, Wall Street Journal subscriptions,
mm-hmm.
and they would get them on their iPads, and it's similar to, I would imagine, like, it was a similar but different than, you know, back when you used to have the paper delivered to your house, and you would sit down at breakfast. Of course, everybody is up hours before they need to be anywhere. This was normal.
I'm still like that, but I guess I'm old.
I don't know. I'll say that I actually don't know. I know that I'm not like that, but maybe there are more people like that than I recognize or would think.
I don't know. I think, most people now probably just get up like right before they have to.
Right. But even then, you know, I think the image in my mind is like the Malcolm in the Middle, that television show. Like, the dad is up. He's at the kitchen table. The kids are at the kitchen table. The mom's making, she's not because she cooked breakfast, but she's also preparing everyone's lunch for the day, right? But everyone's in the kitchen or in the dining room, which are usually right next to each other. And the dad's sitting there, has the paper folded open over his breakfast, and he's kind of eating while reading the news. And the kids are sitting there talking, and the dad's just generally talking about what he's reading in the news. And like, he may look over at his wife and say, oh, did you hear that? Right.
Oh, turns out. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, but there's also a weird social aspect about that too, where I would be willing to bet that a lot, like my dad does this. He gets up every morning, and he's in a slightly different position because he's in a place now where owning his own company, he can show up whenever he wants. But I distinctly remembered being in high school, and he would be sitting in the living room, sitting in the kitchen, which we had a weirdly structured house. You could see the living room, kitchen, and dining room all from the same place. There were no walls between any of them. And he would be sitting at the kitchen table. He'd have his phone out on the table and like a notebook, which is because he's not big on tech. He writes his plan for the day down there and then would just call people and figure out what was going on that day. But he was also having breakfast, and he would sit there and read the newspaper from like 7 a.m. to like 9 a.m. some days, or he would read it for like 30 minutes and then leave. But I also had the opportunity to work with him some when I was very little, like old enough where I'm not really working. I'm mainly just, my mom's telling, take our son and take him out of the house during the summer so he doesn't become lazy. But even then, he would do the same thing. He would take it, he would fold that newspaper up and take it with him to the nearest, you know, contractor supply store, which, yes, you buy supplies there. But if you're a contractor, that's also where you meet with all the other contractors in the morning. And you all sit there, and that's why they offer free coffee. They're all sitting there discussing business in the store where they all buy their equipment, because they're going to buy their equipment to take the job later in the day. This is also why contractors don't show up to your house till like 11, by the way, most of you, or the head contractor doesn't. The plebs might.
They're busy having coffee. Yeah.
Yeah, they're busy having coffee and talking shop with the other contractors, but still maintaining important business relations. But they would talk about the things in the news. They'd all have their copy of the paper and talk about it and be sitting there just, you know. But at that time, and even today, my dad still doesn't internet much. That's where all of his concept of what's going on outside of his daily life comes from. Like, that's the world outside of him, you know? And just by being selective about what is even in that paper changes what he knows about.
Right.
And it doesn't exist if it's not in that paper, or he's told. And that's the same for everybody. But he was limited by the fact that it was a physical piece of paper. Like, there's only so much, and he had to actively read it himself. You know, it wasn't read to him by anybody. Like, I don't know about you, but I get a lot of my news through, like, videos about a news article where someone will sit there and recap headlines for the week or whatever and okay. read it to me. You know, I don't need to read it myself. And I'm also getting the TLDR Cliff Notes version of what's in the news. And you can be exposed to more headlines that way. But I think you're right. Either way, at that time and now, you know, news is driven by most people paying for their news. That still happens, but that's not enough for the news entity to exist or continue to exist. A lot of times they have to rely on advertising. And I think that's the first thing I wanted to talk about a little bit when it comes to the news specifically. Well, not just the news, but like me getting my news from YouTube, that's advertiser driven as well. I don't know why it happens to be this way, but it seems that anywhere you get information, people don't want to pay for their information.
Right.
And so, but they still want it. So the people that want to provide it to them, like a good example is journals, journal storage databases. When I was in college, and when you were in college, I'm sure you had to go look at sources that were in a journal store database.
Yeah.
At some point. And I remember that being very odd because I was like, why can't I just look for this on the internet? Because first of all, Google search engine is way better than any journal search engine I've ever used.
Yes.
But also, it occurred to me that, oh, I don't have access to these anymore. I remember like wanting to look one up and I can't find it because it's behind a paywall. Like, well, I don't want to pay for that to prove a point to someone I may or may not have been arguing with.
Right.
But yeah, information isn't free necessarily. That's the first, I guess, reality around that is that people put barriers to information. And so you have to pay to get it. And it makes sense. People did work to collect that information, you know. But since it has to be paid for and people don't want to pay for it, how do you pay for it and give it to them at the same time?
Yeah.
Well, you take something instead. Instead of taking their money, you take their attention and you sell it to advertisers, right? But that creates, like you said, I think you said before, is this weird incentive to get people to just look at you. And the truth often is not the most interesting thing. Or like right. The plainest version of the truth, I'll say.
Well, that, but also even among things that are true, even if you're just telling the flat news and not embellishing it in any way, you're still incentivized to pick the stories that are going to generate the most outrage.
Right. Interest, outrage. Yeah. And I think that's...
Well, yeah, interest is what you're trying to generate, but outrage is very good at generating interest.
Right. Well, and I think... I don't have the study pulled up in front of me, but I distinctly remember there's our daily CGP gray credit.
Yes. This video will make you angry.
Yes. This video will make you angry. It's a really good video.
It will actually not make you angry. It's a great video.
It might. I don't know. Depends, I guess.
Well, it's a maybe if you title. Make your money by upsetting people.
Sure.
Then you'll be upset that he explains your game. But
right. But the TLDR version of that is that of all of the human responses, you know, they ranked human emotional responses, sadness, happiness, joy. They split hairs on a couple of them. But the one thing that got people the most to like come back and consume more information was anger.
Well, it's not just that. It's anger is more likely to get you to share it.
Yes, that's the other
key point. Because you're like, I'm mad about this. Hey, you, have you seen this? Can you believe that that happened? Yeah.
Well, and more importantly, you might actually want to talk to people that you associate with the source of your anger as well.
Yes.
You know, team building forms around anger.
Mm-hmm.
When people get angry, they look for allies and enemies.
Yes.
And that forms camps. And then he goes on to explain, I think, one of the most important concepts in that video, which is this totem.
Yes. That's the phrase he used. The echo chamber, the opposing echo chambers that build totems of the opposing chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And get... make themselves angrier at their image of their enemy as they perceive it.
Right. And that's interesting because you would think, like, the intuitive thing to me would be that, oh, if you have echo chambers forming, it's people making themselves feel better by reaffirming their worldview, when that's absolutely not what we mean, and what people mean when they say echo chamber. Like, it's people who are angry, but they don't want... Let's back up. When you're angry about something, it doesn't feel good to go to the person you're angry at and then argue with them and them not change their mind. You're just expending anger to be angry at that point. And there's no validation. There's no satisfaction to that, right? But there is satisfaction when people agree with you, which is really what you
want. Look at this. This is unacceptable. Yeah, I can't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes us feel good.
But right, we feel good when other people agree with us, yes.
Right, but it's very unlikely that you're going to get someone who disagrees with you to all of a sudden agree with you. It's a lot easier to find people who already pretty much agree with you to just voice
to complain that. About the enemy, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what we're talking about is these images of who we're mad at. So like it's a bunch of people in the echo chamber, but instead of making each other feel better about, oh, you know, well, we're the smart ones, we don't need to worry about this necessarily, it feels a lot better to be instead, man, I bet those people over there do this as well. And then there's another head on the totem pole where they construct this vilification this exaggerated vilification of this ideal opponent, but it's one opponent that they're all kind of constructing this design by committee around, and it's an arms race of who can come up with the most ludicrous and the most evil. But then there's two groups doing this, which is important because now they both know that each other exists, but clashes between them rarely happen. Because
right, there's people on the fringes who are interacting with the opposing group, but they mostly just talk amongst themselves.
Right. And on an individual level, this is harmful because you can get addicted to this behavior.
Yes.
And social media knows this. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and act like software developers who built social media platforms set out to do this on purpose. I think that the reality is that social media platforms, because they're built by software engineers a lot of the time and are kind of ran by them too, it's solving for a problem or maximizing something as a result of a function. Well, if you're trying to maximize engagement, which is what the marketing person told you will make the most money, okay, well, what sliders can I use to make that happen? And you're ending up with these systems that put these people together. I'm going to drip feed you things that you hate, but only expose you to people that agree with you. You know what I mean? And that creates a perfect cocktail for people who want to stay in a place and be on your site, you know?
Yeah.
And then you can use news to do this. And then you partnering with the news is great because the news wants to spread this to people who want to consume it. You can help connect them to their audience.
And so the money flows.
Yeah. And I think most people, if they were being honest, would realize that they probably exist in one of these echo chambers. I know that we do. There are certain echo chambers that we kind of like and that would want to be a part of. I mean, we create them for ourselves. Like, we have a special chat group with other people where we talk about certain things that we all tend to agree with each other on and like, right?
Sure.
And we intentionally do not invite people to that group who are going to be Debbies about it and argue, because we don't want to argue right now.
Right.
We just want to share things that we're really interested in. But that's but where does that end and an echo chamber begin, right? Because it does make sense to me to have groups where it's like, well, these are just people I want to talk to. We also tend to like to talk to people that we tend to overlap with.
Right.
But when does that become a full-blown echo chamber?
The people that I invited to that group are people that I had already talked to and decided that I liked talking to.
Right.
Anyway, but also noticed a certain overlap.
Right. And don't get me wrong, I think what makes these less harmful is that, fortunately, it's not the case that you have to agree to have good conversation, right?
Right.
You can like talking to someone that you disagree with. That's a thing that exists, fortunately.
Yes. But I've even gotten in arguments, even inside of our so-called echo chamber, I have gotten into arguments about specifics of things before. So, yeah, I haven't like cherry-picked parrots who will just agree with what I say. Yeah.
Right. And I'm not trying to call us out for that necessarily. I think that every human being does this because at the end of the day, sometimes we don't want to argue. In fact, we're much, much, much happier being, you know, I just want to talk about things that I like talking about with people that also like talking about that thing.
Right.
You know, I think it becomes an echo chamber to me when it scales up to being, there are strangers now that you frequently talk to that you don't even need to know who they are. You just need to know that they agree, right?
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of, I think that's where a lot of the, what some people would call virtue signaling comes from, right?
Yes.
Now, virtue signaling in and of itself does not necessarily mean that you are, I think people maybe have a bit of a different idea about what that means, perhaps. But what I mean when I say that is just, you wear on your sleeve your affiliations and your opinions so yes. that you can be easily identified by members that agree with you as well. And that's fine. Like that's the purpose is like, hi, I'm a member of X group. See, I believe in these things and I say the right things, you know? In fact, I'm not exactly sure. And I think a lot of people's complaints about it don't come from it itself. It's when it's hypocritical, right? When you do it only to fit in, not because you actually believe in it, right? Like, is that a fair assessment,
yes,
I think?
Usually. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's the same case for anything, really. Doesn't really matter. I think just being a hypocrite's generally looked down upon.
Yeah.
And weirdly, I think a lot of that, in my mind, a lot of the enforcement of virtue signaling tends to come from within, not without.
I'd say that's true.
Although you will see this game kind of get started where, if you're a member of a tribe, we'll say, and you're virtue signaling to say, look, fellow tribesmen, I'm a member of tribe. The initial critique might come from someone external. They're going to say, oh, well, they don't actually believe that. They're just faking it. And that can cause, I think, this weird kind of arms race to happen, or this weird kind of two things to happen where some people will, of that tribe, will say, we'll double down in defense, whereas others will begin to look skeptically. And I don't know, it borderlines on, weirdly, I think a lot of people's ideas of how religious schisms work, mm-hmm. and like kind of witch hunting behavior. I don't know, it's weird. But once you get that ingrained into a group, it gets really strange to watch that group enforce itself and try to maintain cohesion. But while this behavior, I think, of grouping up is normal for people, I think it's when it starts to take... It's when the actions of the fringe members of that group is when we start paying attention to it as to being potentially harmful, right? So a good example would be is if you're in a group of people that, you know, everyone's like, man, don't you just hate X other group? Even if it's a group that's legitimate to hate for certain reasons, right?
Sure.
And everyone's like, yeah, I really do. And then the arms race begins of like, well, I hate them so much that I this or that. Or they're the worst because they're evil, you know. And they're like, no, they're not just evil. They're the most evil. Eventually, there's going to be a member of your group who believes that hard enough to take some pretty drastic steps.
Sure.
And radicalization, I think, is the term we use for that.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole chain of events essentially is within the scope of mental hygiene, like keeping yourself, you know, pretty comprised of how what you're hearing about affects you. But I don't know. It's an interesting thing because there's a lot of nuance to be had in it as well, because I might say that, you should know as many true things as possible, perhaps.
Sure.
It's good to know true things. But there are some true things that might make you legitimately have a response that you would, right? That might be somewhat extreme.
Sure.
So it's hard to say. And the news definitely contributes to this, but it's not just the news. It's the news plus, I think. But this does bring up an interesting kind of a paper that I've read recently that may or may not have contributed to why we were talking about this.
Okay.
It's about information hazards, and the title of the paper is called Information Hazards, A Typology of Potential Harms from Knowledge, and by Nick Bostrom at Oxford University. So what's interesting about this, I'll read the abstract because I think it's worth setting the tone for the discussion, or the introduction to the abstract. Information hazards are risks that arise from the dissemination or the potential dissemination of true information that may cause harm or enable some agent to cause harm. Such hazards are often subtler than direct physical threats, and as a consequence are easily overlooked. They can, however, be important. This paper surveys the terrain and proposes a taxonomy for them. I applaud this paper because it doesn't necessarily offer up any prescriptions about what we do about this. It just acknowledges that this is a potential thing that exists and we need to have a way to discuss it. So if you're interested, it's fairly short, I would think. It's only 34 pages, which is... Okay, maybe that's not that short, depending on your tolerance for reading, but... It is fairly interesting, but...
It's a pamphlet.
It's a pamphlet, yes.
It's not so bad.
But what Nick Bostrom does in this paper is he goes down and creates this typology of these information hazards. And he does this in... There's two ways. You can do them by the information transfer mode, which this is important for discussing how you're going to receive this information or in what part of the information the hazard exists. And the other one is the effect that it could have potentially. But before we go too deep into information hazards, this is something that, while it might sound new, is actually probably not a new phenomenon to most people, especially in the day and age of spoiler alerts. A spoiler alert or a warning is essentially a warning about an information hazard.
Right. I'm about to talk about something that you may not want to hear about personally. Yeah.
Exactly.
In this case, it's a very... It's mostly an innocuous case.
Sure.
Of... You would be disappointed to know this thing about this other thing in advance of seeing it.
Mm-hmm. And it has a real-world effect.
Right. Your enjoyment of seeing the thing is diminished by knowing this.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because, yeah, one of the most fun things in a film is a plot twist. But if you already know the twist, then you're just... The whole time you're watching, you're like, okay, so when does it happen?
Right.
You know, it's no fun.
It's not as much fun, no. So let's talk
about... By the way, Darth Vader dies.
Okay. In a correlation to that, do you remember when it was the big rage for people to go out and spoil the Harry Potter books?
Yes.
I distinctly remember... I was on the internet at that time. and I remember the memes to be had where there were folks who would buy... They would get access to a copy of the book before other people. They would read the last page... And then they would get in their car and drive to bookstores, which were open late at night for the release of this book. So, obviously, everyone here to buy this copy are the most dedicated of fans. And they would drive by and yell out spoilers. And people got so mad. Like, people got so angry about that. I found that really, really interesting.
Yes.
But it points out just how potent some of these information hazards can be, even in this kind of an isolated case. And I can hear some people saying, like, well, what's the harm? Like, okay, yeah, that's a you know, a-hole thing to do, right? But they didn't hurt anybody.
Right.
I don't know.
But they did.
They did, though.
Like measurably worsen somebody's life. Or multiple people in this case.
Sure. And... Yeah, it is kind of up to societies in some way, or the people of the society, to figure out what the boundaries of it, like, acceptable harm are. Like, I don't think anybody there could have sued them over that. You can't sue for a lost experience necessarily.
No, and I don't think anyone is going to call to, like, make it a criminal offense to spoil some media.
Right. You know, and if you're a utilitarian, you might argue that more joy was had by the spoiling for those people.
That's true. I enjoyed it.
Everybody who watched the video probably enjoyed it and got a kick out of it in some way. But, yeah, you can't deny that there is an effect. And it's a pretty potent one because we care about things that don't matter sometimes. That's the important thing to remember. We're people. People care about things that don't matter sometimes. And I think that's the important thing to realize, too, is that it doesn't matter what the thing is necessarily. What matters is how much the person cares, and that's totally subjective. But that total subjective experience about how much a person cares also directly correlates to just how much those people are willing to do something about it when they care that much. Like, for example, some people don't care that much about their lawns, even though it is objectively a good thing to keep a good lawn, right? Some people don't care.
Objectively?
Yes.
This is the new topic now?
No. I'm not calling you out. I'd be a hypocrite to do so. I'm not virtual signaling on the good lawn gang here.
We do need to do an episode about a paper that I have saved about, like, the tyranny of grass.
The grass menace? The green menace? It gets everywhere. But anyway... But let's just say, in general, it's good to take care of your lawn. Or you would be upset if someone did something to your lawn that you didn't like.
Well, by definition, yes.
There you go. Tautologically speaking, I'm correct. but if I don't tend to care about my lawn, which I don't, I'm the kind of person that pays somebody every 2 weeks to come mow it for, like, dirt cheap, and they don't do a great job, but you know what, it looks passable, right? When you drive by it, you don't look and say, man, that's a terrible lawn. You don't look at it and go, that's a great lawn, But you don't look at it and go, ugh, those people need to mow their lawn. This is all I care about. But some people do care a lot about their lawns. They get out there with the scissors and the ruler and, you know.
Yes, try to turn their front yard into a fairway. Yeah.
Right. So if I see a bunch of kids riding their bikes and one of them drives off the sidewalk into my lawn, I'm not going to blink about it. I'm going to be like, okay, whatever. I might not even care. But someone who tries to keep their lawn like a fairway.
He's going to come out there and shake his cane.
Yeah. Yeah. That's trespassing and destruction of private property. You know, so same thing about a book. I may not care that much about the Harry Potter books. Read them as a kid. Not a big deal. But to some people who, like, that's the thing that they looked forward to all day or all week or all year, it's going to mean something different. So I guess that's the added danger. But I do want to look into some of these information hazards or the taxonomy that Nick Bostrom put together, because I do think it's kind of interesting.
Okay.
And it proposes some other things that are information hazards that we maybe haven't thought about yet. So I mentioned before there's two ways that they're measured. They're by the information transfer mode, as he would say, and then by the effect. So there are six information transfer modes. There's what's referred to as a data hazard, an idea hazard, an attention hazard, a template hazard, a signaling hazard, and an evocation hazard. Those all sound kind of like the same thing, but he does do his best to make them sound a bit different. I think the most easy one to understand is the data hazard. A data hazard is specific data, such as the genetic sequence of a lethal pathogen or a blueprint for making a thermonuclear weapon, if disseminated, creates risks. So,
sure.
It's the data itself that's hazardous to know. The Anarchist Cookbook, for example, is a data hazard, or could be seen as a data hazard. It is sure. A manual for building improvised weapons that I'm probably on a list for just mentioning in this podcast.
Welcome to the list, by the way.
Welcome to the list, by the way, dear listener. First time. But if you may have ducked them the first time, don't go looking it up on the internet or you will be added to a list. It is a very highly controlled and in a lot of circumstances, I think in some countries still a banned book.
Sure.
So, but still, the knowledge of how to create something potentially dangerous would be a data hazard. The next one is an information hazard. An information hazard is a general idea that, if disseminated, creates a risk even without a data-rich detailed specification. Some people would consider fascism as an idea hazard, or racism, or stereotypes even could potentially be an idea hazard.
Okay.
It's just information that could be used, I guess in this case, it could be used to justify certain actions, sort of. It's putting the idea in your head that it's not necessarily, and this is where I kind of disagree with some of the, you're starting to see kind of maybe some breakdowns here, because it doesn't have to be true for it to be dangerous in this case. But the data hazard does have to be true in order to be dangerous in this case. Although the idea hazard, I think if it is true, is even more dangerous. Because you can't argue. So good example is if I, how can I give an example of this without going too edgy? But like, you know, if I give the idea that people who live by the sea are typically more dangerous because pirates existed. Well, it is true that pirates existed. Okay. And you might be able to find some statistics that crime tends to occur more near the sea, for whatever reason. And maybe it's because all crimes on the ocean get like logged to the nearest port, right? Something like that. I'm making,
or because more people live near the sea.
Sure. Or doesn't matter. But the idea that this is a thing might lead some people to say, oh, well, I need to, you know, we need to protect ourselves from the people from the sea. And it's like, okay, now we're getting, you know, this is my not very nuanced artificial example of like what an idea hazard could be.
Yeah.
But another one that I frequently get referred here about is fascism is bad. And then, but for example,
yeah, sure.
Or Nazism, if you want to be specific, if I don't get this thing taken down for saying all the words. The next one I think is way more prevalent And I think we've all known about it, but it's just really weird to think about it as a hazard. And this is, I think, the one that the news kind of propagates a lot. It's the attention hazard. The mere drawing of attention to some particularly potent or relevant ideas or data increases risks, even when these ideas or data are already known. So a good example of this is statistics that reflect some facet of reality that have existed for a long time that people have coped with. Good example would be like car crash deaths. Most people are aware that cars are dangerous and they are aware that people die in car wrecks. That's not new information.
Right.
But the attention hazard comes when though they are highly emphasized more so than normal to give the impression that it happens more frequently. Right. Or repeated exposure to this idea that cars are dangerous, cars are dangerous, cars are dangerous. Most people know that cars are dangerous and they accept that with a risk. But the more that you're bombarded by this thing that cars are dangerous,
today, another person died in a car accident on interstate, whatever, again.
Right. That's an attention hazard because it's changing your perception of reality by changing your attention or your focus.
Right. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to combine this with the next one. The next one's called a template hazard. A template hazard is the presentation of a template enables distinctive modes of information transfer and thereby creates risk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a little bit.
How would you reiterate that in your own words?
It's like a framing, right? Like framing things in a certain way can warp people's perception of reality. Is that kind of what it means?
Sort of. Not all types of information transfer are best thought of in terms of data, ideas, or attention. We can also consider implicit forms of information, such as processes or organizational structures, which can give one firm an advantage over another, and which might be imitated or replicated by a competitor. Similarly, individuals often learn and shape their own personality by emulating some other person. Such emulation can happen unintentionally and even without the awareness that emulation is taking place. A bad role model can pose a template hazard.
Okay.
So it's both. So I think one version of a template hazard is most people know what a newspaper is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that there is a legitimate looking way of information can be presented,
right,
it's hazardous.
The fact that I can put on a white coat and pretend that I'm a doctor is boom, a template hazard.
Okay, exactly.
Got it.
Yeah, it's essentially knowing what something's supposed to look like creates now a vessel that information can be used in to make it a hazard.
Right. So this is why like impersonation crimes exist.
Yes. So attention hazards with this combined are where you get the general hazard of the social media news post hazard,
mm-hmm.
which is a news article, TM, that you call it that because it looks like a news article. There's a headline at the top. There's usually a picture associated. There's an author who you don't recognize and doesn't matter with a date, and it's written a certain way to provide information in a certain way. Not necessarily clinical, but it's written usually narratively, and there's data points and links in it. That template of what I described that most people would call a news article, that is a hazard, arguably, because I could put any information in here and it'd be seen as more legitimate than it otherwise would be if I just laid it out to you and said it to you.
Yeah.
So therein lies the template hazard. And the last one is the signaling hazard. Verbal and nonverbal actions can indirectly transmit information about some hidden quality of the sender, and such social signaling creates risk. And I'll read the full paragraph because this one's also kind of esoteric. We can also register as a distinct mode of communication social signaling, where the focus is not on the content that is being transmitted, but on what this content and the fact that is being communicated says about the sender. Any nonverbal actions can also serve as social signaling role, if they are aimed not only at directly achieving some practical outcome to which they are nominally geared, but also to signal some hidden quality of the agent that performs the action. For example, one could give alms to the poor not only because one wishes to satisfy their needs, but also because one wishes to be seen by one's peers as a kind and generous person. One might utter patriotic statements not only to convey to the listener information about various attributes of one's nation, but also to signal that one's status as a loyal citizen or one's affiliation with some political grouping. So,
yeah, signaling.
This
yeah.
is literally the virtue signaling hazard in a way.
Yes. I can see there being other types of signaling hazards, but yeah, true. This is relevant to what we were talking about before. Yeah.
Right. So those are interesting that we, now that we've discussed like the transfer methods, right? The effects though, I think get a bit subjective. Like I think he's done yeah. a good job with these, but it's interesting to see how you would classify these. So let's talk about and they're grouped into like overarching group, like the risk generated, the type, and then there's subtypes. So let's start with the first one, because this is, I think, is where it gets interesting to me. So the first one is the competitiveness hazard. And this has the effect of creating adversarial risk. So the subtypes of this hazard are the enemy hazard, the intellectual property hazard, commitment hazard, and the knowing too much hazard. So we don't need to go into every single one of these, although I do think it's absolutely fascinating to do so. But it gives you this idea, and I think this one's fairly obvious. Like in a nutshell, it is this idea that it kind of creates, it. This is not unique to this hazard, but it's this idea that there is some other, you first need a distinction barrier, us, them,
mm-hmm.
right? But then there's also this, that us need to be better than them. And that mentality slash behavior. See, this is where it gets interesting, where it's like, it's just information that promotes this behavior that we tend to see as bad.
Right.
Any comment on that one? Or any of those that particularly interest you of the subtype? I mean, the intellectual property hazard, I saw you perk at that one. That was interesting.
Of course, that's my pet topic, as always.
But, I don't know. I think this one, the commitment hazard is an interesting one to me as well.
Okay, I think I might have an idea where this is going.
So let me pull that one up.
I think this is going to be sort of like related to sunk cost fallacy. Like, you're part of this now. You need to see it through, even when you realize that things are going horribly wrong.
So the commitment hazard. There is a risk that the obtainment of some information will weaken one's ability credibly to commit to some course of action.
Oh, so the opposite thing.
Mm-hmm. So this would be seen almost like a temptation hazard. If I, for example, if I say that I am deciding that I'm not going to drink another bit of alcohol, right? Anything that would threaten my commitment to that would be considered a commitment hazard from that perspective. So,
okay.
Advertisements selling alcohol and the wonderful experience you can have when you consume it would be considered a commitment hazard to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. To be fair, the intellectual property hazard is, A, faces the risk that some other firm, B, will obtain A's intellectual property, thereby weakening A's competitive position.
Okay.
So it's information that puts you at an advantage. Being exposed to others poses the hazard in this case.
Okay. So, like, secret hazard then.
Sort of. But this is all in the context of adversaries, right? It's an adversarial risk. So,
right, my adversary getting my secrets.
Right, and I think that ultimately is the effect, is that now that I'm looking at it, yeah. So in general, the competitiveness hazard that houses all of these things is there is a risk that by obtaining information, some competitor of ours will become stronger, thereby weakening our competitive position. So the enemy hazard is you know, essentially information being exposed directly about your enemies to your enemies, things like that. You know, I think that kind of help highlights the effect.
Okay.
This one's interesting to me. The knowing too much hazard. Our possessing some information makes us a potential target or object of dislike.
Mm.
I know too much. that kind of reminds me of that Games People playbook where they named things after kind of the outcome. Very stupid.
Yes.
Or the obvious things that take place. This reminds me of that. Which I appreciate that naming system. I like naming systems that say exactly what the thing is in a
right,
fun way.
Right, where you know exactly what it is as soon as you hear the name of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next group hazard is grouped as the norm hazard.
Okay.
And these are generally risks to social organization and markets. Which are interesting. So, some social norms depend on a coordination of beliefs or expectations among many subjects, and a risk is posed by information that could disrupt these expectations for the worse. So, some examples of these in here is the information asymmetry hazard. Can you guess what the information asymmetry hazard is?
Well, obviously, when somebody has information that others don't.
Yep. Literally, when one party to a transaction has a potential to gain information that the others lack, a market failure can result. Insider trading.
Yes, it's literally is what this trading is.
Yeah. I think more loosely, you could even say that, like, if I knew a buyer, like, say you have some stuff for sale, and I see some of the things you have for sale, and I know somebody that would pay way more than market price because they have a subjective desire to purchase a specific thing that is really hard to find, and you have one, and I buy it just to sell it to them, which is essentially what retail arbitrage is. Some might argue that retail arbitrage is only able to happen because of this hazard.
Sure.
Which I don't necessarily think is bad nor harmful.
No, that's fine. Because, yeah, in that case, you're actually providing a service both to me and that person. Because I want the thing sold for this price, and you're willing to pay that. And that person wants the thing for whatever his price is, and he's willing to pay it. So it's fine.
Right.
But, yes, technically, you could be more helpful to both of us by just connecting us with each other.
Yeah.
But why would you do that?
Right. Some people would say that you're being immoral by not just telling somebody that there's somebody who would pay way more for that you know. But at the same time, if you don't have an incentive to benefit somehow, why would you do that? You know? And don't get me wrong, there might be some reason. Like, if I'm your friend, I might tell you that.
Or if the thing is difficult to move,
mm-hmm.
then maybe you don't think it's worth it to actually facilitate this retail arbitrage yourself and instead say, okay, yeah, I know a guy. Hold on. Let me make a phone call.
Right. So let's move on to the next one in this vein. The unveiling hazard. I'll just tell you what this is, because this one's not very hinting at all. The functioning of some markets and the support for some social policies depends on the existence of a shared veil of ignorance, and lifting of which can undermine those markets and policies.
Okay.
Do we need more?
Such as?
Well, let's see. Entire political philosophies have been constructed around the notion of insurance. For example, in John Rawls' theory of justice, the just social order is defined with reference to what people would hypothetically choose from behind a veil of ignorance, i.e., if they were ignorant about which social role they themselves occupy. A Rawlsian might attribute many of the political difficulties in getting this conception of justice implemented to the fact that voters and political decision makers are in reality not behind the veil of ignorance. Selfish people who know their own circumstances, their socioeconomic class, race, occupation, and so forth, may favor policies that promote their self-interest rather than allegedly fairer policies that they would have chosen from beyond the veil of ignorance.
Okay.
That one, I have a hard time with that one, actually. I think this one is highly subjective because I think that this also goes counterintuitive to self-interest.
Yes.
So I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, for the good of us all, you need to remain ignorant about something.
Well, no. It's if we were going to make a policy, right? Like, say we're voting on people who make X money or less should pay 1% more in tax.
Right. I'm going to make sure that number is just above what I make at least.
Right. Whereas the idea of, but is what is fair to everyone would be, okay, what is the likelihood? How would I feel about that if I were underneath this? Or if yes. I didn't know whether it was going to apply to me or not, would I still be okay with it? Which I think is a very lofty goal to achieve for people, because I don't think most people make any decisions based on, what is the likelihood of me being that person? If it's high and I wouldn't like it, I shouldn't vote for it.
Right.
But that's not how anyone votes for anything anyway.
Right. You just think about where you are.
Yeah. Exactly. And then lastly in this group is the recognition hazard. Some social fiction depends on some shared knowledge not becoming common knowledge or not being publicly acknowledged. But public release of information could ruin the pretense. Shall I read more?
Okay.
Two gentlemen, A and B, are in a small town when A breaks wind. Each knows what has happened. Each might also know the other knows. They can collude to prevent an embarrassing incident. First, B must pretend not to have noticed. Second, A might, without letting on that he knows that B knows, provides B with some excuse for escaping or opening the window. For example, A could casually remark, after a short delay, that the room seems to be rather overheated. The recognition hazard consists in the possibility of dissemination of some information that would constitute or force a public acknowledgement. Only then would the flattest become socially painful faux pas. I love that example.
That is brilliant, actually.
Yeah. But what are some serious things? Here's one. I think. It's responsible for one of the few episodes that we haven't released, I think. I think you could argue that it's a recognition hazard. If you try to, if you seriously, with all of the best intentions, try to look at the world through a meritocratic lens, there are some things that you might realize looking at data that would be very uncomfortable if we all acknowledged them. And we all, I think, kind of pretend don't exist for other reasons, right? So, people are not interchangeable, firstly. Some people are born with more ability, skill, or talent, or sorry, born with more talent than others. And in a meritocratic system, if you claim to be in one, if you begin acknowledging this idea, you are essentially leading to the outcome of, well, should have been born different, too bad. And that's potentially harmful. Like, I could see where some harmful things can come from people believing that. Even if it's true. Even if you have to reward people who do better, it doesn't feel fair to those who can't or don't.
Right.
So I think that's a recognition hazard, for example. So sorry, I should have given a warning to that, but oh well. You're listening to this podcast. Not my fault. Here's another one that is absolutely subjective, the ideological hazard. An idea might, by entering into an ecology populated by other ideas, interact in ways which, in the context of extant institutional and social structures, produce a harmful outcome, even in the absence of any intention to harm. So, this is, I think, kind of the revolutionary hazard, almost, is what I would say, maybe. Or to say that I think this is pretty obvious when you look at maybe introductions and interactions of like different religious groups together, which are inherently ideologically driven.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you have members, here's another good one. Let's look at something like a commune style community that ideologically thinks that everybody should share, right? If I don't buy onto that premise, I could be a hazard to that ideology by being a leech. Like, I could just say, yeah, I think we should share, but then take advantage of
then
that.
Then just intentionally be lazy, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And the example for this one's also pretty good, too. Suppose that Bob believes that Scripture S consists of exclusively literal truths and that he is committed to doing whatever S says ought to be done. Suppose, furthermore, that S contains the presumably false moral statement, "Thou shalt drink seawater," but that Bob is unaware of this. The potential dissemination to Bob of this part of the content of S constitutes an information hazard. The information could harm Bob by inducing him to drink seawater. Note that the conveyance of true information harms Bob here. In this case, the true information that S calls for is drinking seawater. That's an interesting thing, too. If you're sold into an ideology, in order to satisfy the rules of your ideology, any information that would lead you to do that would, I guess, be an ideological hazard. That's interesting. Interesting. We're almost done. I think this is interesting. I'm sorry if you don't think this is interesting.
Well, I mean, so I guess if our... I don't think we need to continue enumerating these. If our listeners care about this, we will link to the paper in the show notes.
Go look it up. It's very, very interesting. I highly recommend. But I think the point trying to be gathered here is that... I think that the point trying to be... that I'm trying to get across, and I think that I've maybe killed in trying to get across here, is that... yeah, there's a tons of different ways and information can make us behave in ways that may be counter to our own self-interest just by knowing it. And I think what makes this particularly interesting is that I think for the longest time, perhaps always in human history, there has been this idea that the information is power, you know, that meme.
Yeah, knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. And therefore, to know more is to be more powerful. This is not the case, according to this taxonomy and what is being suggested by Nick Bostrom here. And I would tend to agree. I think that it was just a consequence of our limitations of access to knowledge throughout the vast majority of human history that made it so that it seemed as though there was no such thing as an optimal amount of information, right?
Mm-hmm.
More is always better. It's like calories. If you've starved for the vast majority of your life, you should always want to be eating more calories. But there comes a point.
But now we have cake. Yeah.
Now we have complex carbohydrates that we make into very sweet, delicious things that you can get fat on. I think that just like food, information is the same way. For the longest time, the more you can get, the better. The more diverse you can get, the better. Until you start getting fat, you know, and your health starts to suffer. I think we're the same way with information in general. So.
Sure, that's possible.
So what do you do about it, I guess? That is the
question. Because you don't want to go around, because I could easily see the meme of information hazards itself being a hazard.
Yep.
By people with power using this as a justification to restrict the flow of information.
Yep.
Saying, look, it's for your own good. I have to keep this from you. Which governments already do. They already keep their secrets and will outlaw certain information for, quote-unquote, the public interest. But really, it's just to save their own face.
Right. Or it's and even if you did this honestly, right? Like, even if you had really good intentions. And I think we talked about this when we talked about nihilism before. Nihilism is an information hazard in and of itself, I think. It is some information that is, I think, true. And there are a lot of components of nihilism that I think that are true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're true because they might just be true, not just because I'm lacking information on them or whatever. I think that they're very compelling and true. But when just faced with that information, it can be really depressing.
People can do irrational things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think about that when I want to talk about it to somebody. That's not a conversation I have lightly, right? With someone?
Right. How is this person going to react to the idea of nihilism?
Yeah. Exactly. And while I do agree that people are, especially consenting adults, should be able to have access to whatever they want, make their own choices for themselves, and there is a huge danger here with people essentially asserting that, well, I get to be the minister of truth here, or the minister of information.
Everybody wants to be the minister of truth, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, we're like, man, yeah, people need to be kept safe from themselves. They're all idiots. and you know, we have to restrict information and so on. So, but I don't want anyone to do that for me.
Right. Because that person might be an idiot.
I am intelligent. Yeah. I can handle it.
Right.
But everybody else feels that way too.
Yeah. And good luck finding anybody that, and here's the thing, you have to get everybody to agree. Good luck.
Good luck. Yeah.
But yeah, your ministry of truth becomes a new source of information hazards, or what's most interesting, I think, about how these hazards are structured is they're contextual hazards. By just creating an information bureau, you're creating the potential to make more hazards. It's just like making something illegal will result in more crimes.
Right.
That's similar in that scenario. But I do think that we need to acknowledge it. I think it's important enough, and we are at a place in our human development where we need to acknowledge that this is a thing. Just like we as human beings, especially in first world or the West or whatever you want to call it, developed countries are beginning to realize that, oh, we have too much food. We have too much good food that's high in calories that can make you very sick if you don't. That's not something that throughout the vast majority of human history, people did not need to care about what they ate. Just getting enough was the problem. Now we have to relearn and retrain that behavior. How do you deal with the excess, you know? And just like technology brought us that problem, technology brought us this problem of information hazards. Because if anything, the internet has done an amazing job at making the dangers of information apparent. Because there's more information being added to the internet every day than you could ever consume in your lifetime. Now, you could argue that the vast, vast majority of that is useless information. But isn't that also hazardous? To sit there and consume? Like, I would argue that endless streaming videos about the same thing that don't contribute to your life at all, but they're so attention grabbing.
Yes, it's bad. Hazardous.
Yeah, it's bad for you. As a person who watches way too much internet, like YouTube videos myself, I'm aware that, you know, if you sit down and I think that's why tools that monitor your usage, invest in those if you're interested. Like, you know, good faith way is to look at how much you actually use it and then figure out whether that seems right or not to you, you know, and then maybe also compare that to the time that you would spend doing something else. Maybe you commit to that. I think one of the most important ways we can also deal with this, and I've mentioned this before about a specific individual. I mean, we both know who Tim Pool is, and I've said more than once to you, that man needs to touch grass. This guy reads the news for a living. He reads massive amounts of news articles, condenses it down, and then hands it on to other people. That's what he does, essentially, for a living. And it's a really interesting way to watch in real time somebody being affected by information. And not only that, but it's snapshotted because he posts every single day, 4 or 5 times a day.
Right.
You can go back and see how he was a week ago today. Watch his mental state fluctuate. Again, I'm not trying to say that he's mentally ill or that he needs help or whatever, but I'm just looking at him. I think he panics about a lot of things that I don't panic about, you know?
Right. He's sort of becoming detached from reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's dangerous.
Because he lives in the paper now. Yeah.
Yeah. But at some points you do need to know things that aren't in your everyday life. So how do you pick?
You can't just totally isolate yourself from the outside world, because then something will happen that is going to affect you that starts far away and you do need to know about it.
Right. And so how do you know without looking? Because that's the problem. These hazards, and what makes information hazards so interesting, is that just knowing about them is all you need.
It's like quantum physics, the observer effect.
Mm-hmm. But
you have to look, but looking changes things.
Yep. And I don't quite know how we solve that problem, but I think that it's at least important that we are all aware of it. I think that would explain, I think a lot of people would be a little bit more skeptical about the things that they read, or at least more self-aware. Like when you read something, think about how it makes you feel, and is it okay that it makes you feel that way? You know, like if you're someone who suffers from like body dysmorphia or something like that, maybe watching a bunch of videos about physical trends, like how to work out certain parts of your body or how to dress or whatever to hide certain things, maybe these aren't the best things for you. Like if you're already anxious about the way you look, but then you consume a bunch of content that gives you different ideas about what
yeah, is maybe the best stop to watching things that make you even more uncomfortable and give you more things that you feel like you have to do to be whole again.
Right. But at the same time, if you're legitimately an unhealthy person, maybe you should look at some stuff to talk to figure out how to be healthy. But I think the difference is you need to decide up front what you're trying to do.
Right.
And then
what is your goal now? And don't let somebody else hand you a goal. Yeah.
Yeah. Pick your own goals, stick to them, and then let the information that you find, look at it through the lens of your goal. Is this helping me achieve my goal or not? If not, get rid of it, move on, find something else. You know, instead of just passively absorbing this information that's presented to you.
And feeling worse about yourself.
Yeah. Right. And this is the funny thing. I think that we've already been given the tools to do this. The algorithm works for you, realistically, at the end of the day. It's supposed to. Because the whole goal...
is to keep your attention.
Is to keep your attention.
So if you stop giving it your attention when it's doing bad things to you, it will find something else to feed you.
Exactly. So...
that is hopefully more appropriate.
Hopefully. But... philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.